Some of us are old enough to remember seeing the Washington columnist Mary McGrory on Meet the Press and similar TV programs. In fact, you don't have to be that old. Mary McGrory enjoyed a long career in journalism, writing her first columns in the Eisenhower administration and her last in the George W. Bush years. She died a decade ago. She's the focus of a new biography, Mary McGrory, the First Queen of Journalism. John Norris wrote it. He worked in a number of senior roles in government, including at the State Department and the United Nations. His writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and other publications. John is currently a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Hi, John. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeff.
I don't know whether to ask why you wanted to write about her or what took you so long.
Both. You know, Mary, just I knew her a little bit when she was alive and had that pleasure. And the more I knew about her, it just really struck me as the she was the kind of person, she's the reason you write biographies. It was just a great life, a fascinating career, and nobody'd really told the story. So I saw an opportunity there.
Help us wrap our brains around just her time span. I mean, what was the first thing she covered for her column in Washington?
Her big breakthrough was covering the Army-McCarthy hearings in 1954. She'd been a book reviewer in Boston, then in Washington, but her editor asked her to go cover the Army-McCarthy hearings, and her columns, she covered each day of the hearings and produced a column for each day of the hearings, almost immediately became a national sensation.
What was the thing that prompted him to turn a book reviewer into a political columnist?
Well, you know, Mary had a reputation around the office as somebody with a sharp wit. She was clearly a beautiful writer. Her book reviews were always well-crafted. And she advocated for years, both in Boston with a Boston Herald Traveler, then at the Washington Star. She really wanted to cover politics, but she kept being told by her male editors that it really wasn't the right place for a woman. It probably wasn't appropriate. And she kept on them, and finally they were willing to give her a shot.
So back to her time span. So her first shot came during the Army-McCarthy hearings, which she covered quite ably, and then worked all the way into the George W. Bush administration. Was she something like Batman? I mean, did she strike fear into the hearts of the people she wrote about?
In person, she was invariably soft-spoken, very ladylike, almost Victorian in her manners. But being featured in Mary's columns did strike fear into people that she wrote about. One of my favorite quotes about Mary came from Bobby Kennedy, who said, Mary's so gentle until she gets behind a typewriter. So she was very sweet and very kind in person, but she did write with a very sharp pen.
How much of a novelty in 1954 was it to have, and I'm going to use their words at the time, a gal covering hard news?
Almost unheard of, that there were very few women in the newsroom. It was a time when women, if they wanted to be reporters, really had a fairly stark choice between working in the newspaper business or getting married. Getting married was a firing offense at most newspapers. A number of women who did get married went so far as to hide their marriages so they wouldn't have to quit. And most of the time that Mary was on the campaign plane or campaign bus, making her rounds in the certainly in the 50s and into the 60s, it was usually her or one other woman on the entire bus or plane.
That whole section about you're working or you're married just floored me. I mean, the idea that your boss would say you're married, into my office now.
It would
stops your heart.
It would turn most HR directors' hair instantly gray if they heard some of the stuff that was said to her. And Newby Noyes, her editor at the Washington Star, before he gave her the big break at covering the Armand-McCarthy hearings, sat her down and asked, well, are you going to get married and go have kids? And if you're not, we think we can do more with you and we'll give you more of a chance. So again and again throughout her career, really was a very stark choice for her between her private life and her public life.
And it sounds like Newby Noyes put himself out on a bit of a limb here. It sounds like there were not generally good feelings, certainly not unanimous good feelings about her new role.
Some of the editors underneath them got a lot of grief from other newspaper editors and colleagues for letting a woman so prominently cover politics. Mary would show up at campaign events and people would ask if she was the head of the volunteers or the candidate's wife, and she would insist that she was a reporter, and they'd often ask her again before they were convinced. But Newby, I think, was quite shrewd. He was from an old newspaper family, and he recognized Mary's talent, and that he quickly pushed her towards syndication, which she resisted a bit. And he knew that she had something, and her style was reverent and conversational, and he gave her the simple advice to write about politics like she was writing a theater review, which she stuck to her entire career. So I think Newby made a smart choice, and he defended her against all comers.
You know, the craftedness, though, worked against her sometimes as far as time pressure went, and it sounds like working a column on a deadline did not come easily, at least at first.
As a writer, one of the wonderful things about Mary is that she absolutely labored over her work. She would sit at her desk smoking cigarettes and crumpling up drafts that she didn't like into little tiny balls of paper and throwing them on the floor. And one of her colleagues took to calling these her anguishes. And one morning he came in and saw and counted that there were 35 wads of rolled up paper around her desk. And he said, "Oh, 35 anguishes. It must have been quite a night." You know, and she worked hard and she really wanted to get it right. And she labored well into the night because it was her craft and she took it very, very seriously.
We are talking about Mary McGrory here on the Jefferson Exchange, the first queen of journalism, made a Washington Star columnist in the mid-50s and got quite a splash at the Army McCarthy hearings, all related in John Norris's book, Mary McGrory, the First Queen of Journalism. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return from this break. Back on the Exchange with John Norris about Mary McGrory and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about Mary McGrory. She was a longtime columnist in Washington, D.C., starting with the Army McCarthy hearings, a political columnist in the mid-1950s, and worked for pretty much the next 50 years between the Washington Star and the Washington Post after the Star shut down. The book about her by John Norris is called Mary McGrory, the First Queen of Journalism. John Norris is our guest on the Exchange, and you can join our discussion at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned that the Army McCarthy hearings did a lot for Mary McGrory's reputation, really established her. Great place to start, certainly. What were the kinds of things that she was reporting out of the hearings?
You know, she always worked as somebody who was a mix of what we would think of today as an opinion columnist or an op-ed columnist and a beat reporter. Her stories usually were featured either on the front page or the third page. And we're somewhat used to it now, but at the time it was fairly revolutionary that she really talked about politicians and characters on the grand national stage in very personal and very conversational tones. And, you know, that she took one look at McCarthy and said that, you know, this was a guy she'd seen all her life, that this was she'd seen him at Irish wakes and funerals back in Boston, and that he was just a bully. You know, and she wrote about him that way. And it brought, I think, this touch to politicians that was really new for readers and helped them understand them as people and what drove them and what motivated them in really lyrical and often funny ways. And I think that it was just so different from the kind of traditional wire service story of he said, she said, lay out the lead, lay out everything that follows. You came away from Mary's story with much more understanding of what was going on and a great read in the process.
She put people in three dimensions, in a sense.
Yeah, one of her former colleagues said that she could tell what kind of person somebody was by the hairs on the back of their neck.
I read that quote. I thought that's a real good skill.
That is a great skill. And, I don't honestly know quite how she picked it up, but she was a very astute read of people. And I think that really carried out in her columns. And I think part of the reason that she was such a good read of people was because she got out of the office, that she, unlike a lot of columnists, that she went to every congressional hearing. She traveled on the campaign plane and the campaign bus, and she demanded to really be there in kind of the front row, and said that maybe it was a limitation, but she really felt she couldn't understand what was going on unless she was there to see it and feel it in person.
So help us understand why the Star displayed her stuff on page one or page three rather than in the editorial section.
You know, I think it was because so much of it was done from field reporting. That she took the advice of a friend to kind of behave like a police reporter, a very polite and well-dressed police reporter. But she went out and got out there and asked those questions and mildly interrogated people. So it had a very different feel, and it wouldn't have really belonged on the op-ed page in some ways because it wasn't the traditional ivory tower punditry that most people were used to at that time. But it was also quite unusual for the first or third page in that it wasn't hard to tell where Mary came down on issues. And it was one of the real strengths of her work, but it also did raise some ethical and real questions about journalistic practice in terms of what was opinion and what was hard reporting.
We're talking to John Norris about his book, Mary McGrory, The First Queen of Journalism. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. She had a marvelous body of work. I have two questions. First of all, of all the work, what do you think she would have thought was the most important work that she did and that she was most proud of? And then secondly, what do you think she would think of the state of investigative journalism in America today? And I'll take my answers to my questions off the air.
All right. Excellent questions. Thanks for those, Paul. Appreciate it.
You know, I think in terms of her most important work, I think the column she did after Kennedy's assassination, and she knew Kennedy well, and they were friends, and they both came from Boston and kind of worked their way up on the national stage at around the same time. They're really incredible columns. They hold up really well today. She was crushed with tragedy, and even under that weight, she still churned out some of the most poignant, heartfelt columns that you can imagine that are still used to teach writing in journalism classes today. Also, her work on Nixon. She loved a good enemy, and Nixon was the best of enemies, and they had wonderful mutual contempt for each other, and I think her writing on Nixon just really, really sings with outrage. And I think that the other thing is just the sheer volume of work that Mary produced for most of her career, four columns a week, which is really just a prodigious amount of copy by today's standards. You know, I think there'd be some things that Mary would like today and some that she wouldn't. You know, she was not a nostalgic person. I remember an interview with Tim Russert fairly late in her life where Russert kind of asked her, you know, do you miss the good old days? Was it better back then? And she said, well, are you thinking of Nixon? Are you thinking of McCarthy? Are you thinking of the Red Scare? And she, I think, rejected the idea that things had been kind of a misty ideal in the past. But, you know, she was something of a technophobe, and I'm sure she would not like the fact that reporters now have to maintain their, not only their reporting and writing, but their Twitter account and their Facebook page and Instagram and updating stories seven times a day. And certainly she would loathe the average comment section on internet posting. But, you know, I think that she would also appreciate that there's a lot of people doing interesting work. I think she would bemoan the financial straits that face the industry as a whole that are making good investigative journalism much, much harder to carry out. So I think she would have a very mixed view of it today.
I'm curious to know, too, if she had any thoughts. I mean, she lived long enough to see the birth of Fox News and the growth of flavored journalism in cable TV, and I wondered if she had an opinion about that.
Yeah, she generally sniffed in distaste at it. I think that just the sheer amount of punditry required to fill cable news, whether it was CNN or Fox or even MSNBC, I think that there's a tendency just to put people on and have them talk just to keep the cameras rolling, and that it's often not particularly well-informed. And she, despite her strong political beliefs, really did, she didn't like shouting much, and she believed that people should be able to have a polite exchange of views. She'd go on Meet the Press because Tim Russert was a friend, but she always stayed away from the McLaughlin Group and other shows like that because she really didn't want to be in shouting contests first thing on Sunday morning.
Right, I could see that point. Let's take another call from Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Norris, the author of Mary McGrory, the First Queen of Journalism.
Hiya. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about Bobby Kennedy's involvement with the Army McCarthy hearings, and is that when Mary McGrory first met him? And can you talk a little bit more about her relationship with the Kennedys, and also any opinions she might have had about the Bay of Pigs that happened in early 61, just after John Kennedy came into office, and how the CIA and Nixon had sort of set up that whole thing, and if she had any opinions about that.
Okay,
anyway,
bunch of threads there to untangle. Thanks for that, Skeeter.
Sure. Mary had an enormously complex relationship with Bobby and certainly the whole Kennedy clan. A lot of times she's seen, without a very careful reading, as kind of being a knee-jerk Kennedy supporter. She really wasn't at the get-go. She was a huge fan of Adlai Stevenson. She thought he was a bit of a disaster as a politician, but thought that he was smart and literate and moral, and loved the fact that he fretted over every speech like he was working on someone's last rites. And so the Kennedys took considerable umbrage that Mary wasn't all for Jack's presidential campaign right from the beginning, because they said, you're from Boston, we're from Boston, we're both Irish Catholic, we're in this together. And she resisted that to a degree, but certainly she became very fond of Jack. They had a date once when he was a single congressman living here in Washington that didn't really go anywhere. But in a lot of ways, Jack Kennedy was an ideal for Mary in terms of a politician who was smart and funny and quick on his feet and self-deprecating and willing to learn from his mistakes. Bobby, she got to know less during Army McCarthy, more during the Teamster hearings, watching him tangle with Jimmy Hoffa. In a lot of ways that Mary always thought that Bobby just ran too hot, that he was too confrontational, that he was too for us or against us to be an effective politician. That said, though, as Bobby, particularly after his brother's death, became more interested in social justice issues, he and Mary grew closer. They both shared a very deep and abiding sense of faith in their outlook. And Mary leaned really hard on Bobby to jump in the race in late 1967, 1968, to take on LBJ because she was adamantly opposed to the Vietnam War, and she was incredibly frustrated that he was slow to do that, and in turn became quite an adamant supporter of Eugene McCarthy for his willingness to take on LBJ. And Mary and Bobby had some very tough words for each other after Bobby eventually did get into that race.
Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk with John Norris about Mary McGrory, the First Queen of Journalism, his new book, 800-838-3760. By phone, email is jx@jeffnet.org. So let's come back to the beginning. What was it about Mary McGrory's background as an Irish Catholic girl, I guess in the Boston area, that would have propelled her toward this career?
It's like those, I remember when I was a little kid that there, and it may be apocryphal, the famous study of a bunch of engineers got together and looked at a bumblebee and decided that it couldn't fly. There was absolutely nothing from her background that should have propelled her on this. She grew up in a lower middle class family in Boston. She was the Her dad was a postal clerk. She was the first one to go to college. They had no particular wealth or in the industry. Mary read a cartoon about a pioneering woman reporter when she was a little kid, became fascinated by it. And from looking at her journals and diaries at the time, which her family very graciously shared, she decided as early as 12, 13 that she wanted to be a reporter. And against all common sense and against every way the wind was blowing in the industry, set about doing it and kind of clawed her way onto the book page and got a few breaks and then went from there. But it was something that she really achieved through force of will.
You mentioned her deep and abiding faith and her almost Victorian manners. Was Mary McGrory a little prudy, John?
You know, it's in some ways, I think certainly when it came to the physical side of romance, I think she was a bit of a prude. And I think that part of that was certainly shaped by the fact that she came up in the industry at a time when romantic entanglements could mean the end of your career. So she, I think, was very careful in her appearances and was amazingly private about her romantic life, that most of her family, most of her friends had very little idea of kind of what was going on in terms of her romantic life. But in other ways, she was absolutely not a prude. You know, and it also explains why she got along so well with the boys on the bus, that she liked to drink scotch. She smoked cigarettes until she quit in the 1990s. She could talk about ward politics and make up funny songs about candidates and stay up till 3 a.m. at the bar, and was an awful lot of fun in that regard. So it was a very funny mix of somebody who was, as you say, somewhat prudish in other parts of her life, but absolutely rollicking in others.
Interesting. Really one of the boys, though, for sure, on the campaign trail. You do get to her love life in the book, including a fellow named Vito Rispoli. Did it lead to anything?
No, you know, Mary, she never married. She never had kids. And I think that in some ways she was attracted to relationships that probably wouldn't work in the end because it didn't force her to choose. Not only was the industry pretty hostile to the idea of a married woman, you know, it was also incredibly threatening, I think, for a lot of men at the time to think of dating a woman or marrying a woman who was more successful than you were. She ended up syndicated in close to 200 papers around the country, and the idea of, for a lot of men then and probably still now, of marrying somebody who had a bigger byline than you can be somewhat intimidating, I think. So the Vito who you refer to, she had kind of a brief almost fling with on one of her Italian vacations, you know, and it was, she was very attracted to him, wanted it to work, but at the end of the day, just pulled away.
Hmm. So back to her work, we mentioned about her closeness with the Kennedy family. Did date JFK once, but they stayed friends. Her friendship certainly helped her in 1960. And there's a great story that you relate in the book about her sitting in this car between JFK and Adlai Stevenson, which is just a great transitional moment in American politics. Let's talk about LBJ, though, because she did get reasonably close to him while he was in the Senate, and I'm curious to know how cordial a relationship that was.
You know, they were close. They were very different people. You know, and I think in a lot of ways, Mary recognized that he was an extremely competent politician.
I really need to say here, I'm sorry, I use LBJ because I lived in the 60s and it's the short end. Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president after Kennedy, for the younger folks.
Yeah, so, you know, that she really appreciated his skills as a master politician, as somebody who could move heaven and earth in the Senate and between flattery and twisting arms, and, you know, he knew how to get things done. But in a lot of ways, that for her was such a tough transition after John Kennedy's presidency to that of LBJ, that he was not as polished. He was monumentally insecure. He could be quite gruff in his mannerisms. And he fancied himself quite good with reporters, but he wasn't always. And certainly once the Vietnam War began to gather steam, that became an issue that she was just so opposed to that it became a an implacable obstruction in their relationship.
Well, yeah, and when LBJ was president and was having his issues with Walter Cronkite, I mean, how much was Mary a barometer for the American feeling about the Vietnam War?
You know, I think Mary, in a lot of ways, was a really important voice against the war, that she, I think, gave a lot of credibility and momentum to the idea that respectable establishment characters could disagree with the war and could disagree adamantly with the course in Vietnam. That, you know, Mary was a lot of things, but there was no mistaking her for a wild-eyed hippie. You know, she leaned towards Chanel suits, impeccable table manners. That, and she thought the war was just a huge moral error and a strategic quagmire, and said it again and again. And having interviewed a lot of people who knew Mary when they were students in the anti-war movement, again and again, they all came back to the idea that Mary was incredibly supportive and really gave them important cover to bring their issue in opposition to the war to a much larger and much more respectable audience.
A whole lot of ways in which she influenced the dealings of Washington. For the better part of five decades, Mary McGrory is the subject matter. The book is Mary McGrory, the First Queen of Journalism. John Norris, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can join us when we come back from this break. Back on the Exchange with John Norris and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Norris. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., has written a great deal of material for The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and other publications, and worked extensively in senior roles in government, including at the State Department. He is the author of a book about one of the major figures in American journalism. Mary McGrory, the First Queen of Journalism, is the title of his book about her. Mary McGrory was a columnist for first The Washington Star, then The Washington Post, was syndicated along the way as well to 200 papers across the country. Her career covered basically a 50-year span from the mid-50s to the mid-aughts. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So a lot of Mary in the book, in addition to just what her interesting political work was, or her column making, but she did a lot of volunteer work in Washington, too. Tell us about how that started, John.
You know, Mary just believed in giving back, and that was something I think she brought from her faith. She showed up at St. Anne's Infant and Maternity Home here in Washington, D.C., not long after she moved here in the early 50s, and insisted that she wanted to volunteer at the orphanage. They'd never had a volunteer before. They didn't quite know what to do with her. But it kind of set off an amazing 50-year love affair between Mary and the St. Anne's Orphanage and the kids at St. Anne's, that she would go in literally every week that she wasn't on the campaign trail, at least once a week, read to these kids. She'd help out with Christmas parties and buy them presents out of her own pocket, help out the teachers. She'd wade into the D.C. court system to look after the interests of the kids. You know, and this is taking care of orphans in Washington, D.C., and particularly as you got into the 80s and 90s when you had the crack cocaine epidemic in Washington. You know, this is not the stuff of being a limousine liberal, that it is hard work. It's very labor-intensive. It really demanded getting to know the kids on a personal level. And she stuck to it for five decades plus. You know, and it's, you know, people joke about going to help at the orphanage on the weekend. And, you know, this was somebody who really did it, and not only did it herself, but dragged both willing and unwilling her friends and colleagues to volunteer as well.
But yeah, apparently she was quite aggressive about recruiting other volunteers.
Oh, yes. Maureen Dowd used to joke that her work at St. Anne's was what led Mary to be described as she who must be obeyed.
And volunteering even appears in Mary McGrory's gravestone, I see.
Yeah, that she wanted just a newspaper woman and volunteer on her gravestone, and those were the, for her, those were the two most important things. And, you know, that she once joked that in public remarks that she felt rather sorry for anybody who didn't work in the newspaper business, even though she probably admitted she shouldn't say that out loud.
Interesting. And she became very influential very fast. I mean, granted, when you're starting with the Army McCarthy hearings and you're saying things that are important about it, that's likely to happen. But, I mean, the New York Times, for example, started recruiting her to jump ship. How did that go over with Mary?
You know, she was quite intrigued by it. Scotty Reston, who was the famous Washington bureau chief and famous opinion writer in his own right at the New York Times, reached out to recruit Mary very shortly after the Armand McCarthy hearings. And it was all going rather swimmingly until Scotty Reston insisted that in addition to writing a column for the New York Times and being a reporter, she would have to also answer the phones in the morning, you know, which is unimaginable that you would take somebody who was already a national sensation as a reporter and a columnist, and just because she was a woman, say that she would have to cover the phones. And Mary was horribly offended and just kind of left it at that. But it really does speak to how entrenched sexism was in the industry at the time.
Which raises the question then, were the overtures about how good she was at what she did or about the novelty of what she did being a woman?
You know, I think it was a combination of both. I think that there was a certain novelty to it, that somebody like Mary kind of prowling the halls of Congress and writing well and buttonholing senators and congressmen in the hallways did feel different and felt very modern at the time. But I don't think it would have lasted very long as an experiment if she wasn't really, really good at what she did. I think that you reading the cables back and forth between her editors and her from the campaign trail, they marveled at the quality of the copy that she would turn in, oftentimes typed out on an old Royal typewriter on the back of a bus at 2 a.m. in Des Moines, which are not the easiest situation for any writer to write, but she would still churn out stuff that was had a real lyricism and a real poetry to it.
I have to laugh, though, about the way she did use her gender to her advantage, because she had these people hanging around her at times called Mary's Bearers. Who were these people?
You know, Mary, I think, decided that, you know, by her lonesome, she wasn't going to write sexism in the United States or in the newspaper business. And she figured, well, if she was going to sometimes get paid less or have to fight harder or write better than her male colleagues just to get by, she was going to damn well make sure they carried her bags onto the plane and from the office and to the train. And so Mary had pretty much insisted that whenever she was traveling, that her fellow reporters and sometimes even the candidates would help her out with her bags. And, you know, it was a different time. They were always happy to do it and somewhat gracious about it. But I don't think there's ever been a collection of bellhops that between them had more Pulitzer Prizes than Mary's Bearers.
That was a great turn of phrase by you in the book, yeah, about the bellhops with the Pulitzer Prizes. She did entertain at her Washington home, too. I mean, and who were the people who showed up, and what were the soirees like?
You know, Mary had great parties. There were funny parties. I think that, again, as a single woman in the business, that she would go to parties in the 50s and 60s, and this was a time when, after dinner, the women would repair to one room to talk about books and gossip and do other things, and the men would go drink scotch and smoke cigars and talk politics. And nobody knew what to do with Mary. Did she go in with the men and talk politics, or did she retire to the kitchen with the women? So she really began on insisting on hosting her own parties. And there were great eclectic collections of people. You know, I went to a couple of them, and at one of the first ones I went to, Roger Mudd, the legendary CBS anchorman, and I had the same duties. We were supposed to take drink orders for people. And it was a mix of, you'd see Supreme Court justices, you'd see copy boys, you'd see nuns. The food was always awful. People were expected after a couple of drinks and dinner to have a song or a poem or something to recite. And they usually ended up in fairly drunken song by the end of the night.
All right, I was going to ask you how you knew her, and it was through these parties?
You know, both through my job at the time was working in the State Department. She'd call me every once in a while as a source. and we just kind of chat on background about what was ever happening internationally. But also, I got dragged into helping out with the kids at St. Anne's, like so many other folks. So I got to watch Mark Shields and Tim Russert dress up as Santa Claus and pretend they were asleep on a couch as they were woken up by a bunch of orphans singing jingle bells quietly, then louder, and then to go to some of the parties. So Mary was quite good about sweeping. You know, I was fairly young, not that long out of grad school, working in Washington. And for somebody who was into her late 70s and 80s by this point, she was still very open-minded, liked being surrounded by young people, liked hearing about people breaking into Washington and trying to get by. And she really fostered, a very interesting environment.
We talked about a few of the people who she wrote about and just brushed briefly past Richard Nixon. You describe her as the guy that she loved to loathe. How hard was she on Nixon in his presidency, and even before, for that matter?
You know, some of her great pieces were on Nixon. She became the first woman to win a Pulitzer for commentary, in large part because of the Watergate hearings and her columns on Nixon. You know, and the stuff on Watergate and his earlier political career, you know, she described the mix of evil and ineptitude during Watergate as the equivalent of a Marx Brothers, as retold by the German General Staff. You know, she was incredibly tough on Nixon. She recognized that at times he was very skillful in as a politician, but she always struggled with the fact that he was just such an uneasy politician. He didn't really like people. He didn't have a natural charisma. He was quite awkward in social settings. And she just always thought that he was miscast. And then when it came out that Mary had been put on the enemies list by Nixon, that he had mobilized the U.S. government to against his opponents, including Mary, he'd had the IRS launch a series of tax audits against her, which, for me, that's kind of the perfect Mary-Nixon relationship, that Nixon sixed the IRS on Mary, and she ends up getting a larger refund because of her charitable giving to orphans at St. Anne's. You know, and just talk about a classic clash of characters.
Was there a pinnacle, you'd say, to Mary's career, a defining moment?
You know, I think in looking at her career, I think the moments that really stand out are she was able to take those great moments on the national stage and help us understand them and accept them and think about them differently, whether it was Kennedy's funeral, whether it was the Armin McCarthy hearings, whether it was Watergate, whether it was September 11th. You know, and I think that in some ways that she, at a time when we have so much news and so much information, she understood that part of her role as a columnist and a journalist was to help us understand them and help illuminate them and help us think differently about them. So I think it was those great moments when Mary's writing was really its finest.
In fact, you print her column on John F. Kennedy's funeral in its entirety in the book. That's quite a pedestal. Mary McGrory, obviously a lot that she talked about in her life. You mentioned 9/11 just now. Now, she had stepped on the toes of quite a few political figures, and did she get sideways with the Bush White House over her views on 9/11 and what followed?
Well, you know, if you go back and read the column that she wrote in the wake of September 11th, if you read it today, it would sound pretty non-controversial, that she said that George W. Bush, in the hours after the Twin Towers and the Pentagon were attacked, that he was halting, that he was indecisive, and that he didn't particularly rise to the moment. You know, and I think that's something that most historians and most members of the public would probably agree with today if they kind of look back at, from him being interrupted reading My Pet Goat to being shuttled around to different Air Force bases to referring to terrorists as folks. You know, it was not his finest moment. You know, and Mary said that and was pretty honest about it. And she got an absolute cascade of hate mail. You know, I went through all of her letters and all of her files, and it was more than she got during Watergate. It was more than she got during the Army-McCarthy hearings, in very vituperative, very personal terms, often quite offensive. And it was a moment when people were really upset. And I think that there is something to being willing to speak honestly at those moments when you run a risk of a real public backlash. And that was a moment when she got one. But I think from the long view of history that she was probably on the right side of things.
Which may explain the greatest part of her genius, in addition to the way she said the things she said, was just her ability to stand aside, it sounds like, from what was going on in the moment and figure out a larger context for it.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was funny during the Florida recount between W and Al Gore that some of the other columnists were, particularly David Broder at the Washington Post, were saying that this was a great national tragedy to have an election unresolved. And, you know, and Mary was like, this is democracy. This is the republic. It's interesting and intriguing, and it's got high stakes, but the republic will carry on and we'll live to see another day, and that this isn't a great tragedy. And I think that keeping that sense of perspective was really valuable to her work.
Is there anybody still writing who fills the role that Mary McGrory filled, although in a very different journalistic world?
You know, there isn't anybody that kind of immediately leaps to mind. And I think part of those are those forces that we touched on a little bit of columnists are expected to also be media personalities and maintain their Twitter feeds and are writing books on the side and working on the speaking circuit. You know, and Mary just wanted to write her column, and she just wanted to do the reporting on her column. She at one point got a series of book deals, offers for books from major houses on the same day. She said, no thanks. She didn't like doing TV much. She really disliked public speaking. She just wanted to do what she did. And I think it's very rare to find somebody in the industry who's both got the talent that she brought to the table, but also maintains that absolute focus on doing one thing.
Somebody who was really monumental in a way, and yet you know, liked the small stature that she had in a lot of ways. Mary McGrory, The First Queen of Journalism, is the book. John Norris is the author. John, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
Take it easy.